When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, the unscripted show that celebrates unsung heroes, myth busts historical lies, and rediscovers the forgotten stories that changed our world. I'm your host, Scott Rank.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to our series where we're looking at the most historically inaccurate movies that have ever been made. Steve, I'm really interested in digging into this movie because when you mention the Alamo to people of a certain age, I'm thinking, Gen Xers or maybe older millennials in the 40s, 30s age range. And you mentioned the Alamo. What almost anyone will mention is Pee-wee's Big Adventure, where Texans laugh at Pee-wee because he asked if the Alamo has a basement, and they tell him that it doesn't. And then they'll know the phrase, remember the Alamo, but with no context whatsoever about what that means. So are you excited about peeling back many, many layers of what the Alamo is, both in historical fact and in film as well?
Absolutely. In this movie, The Alamo from 2004, I loved it. And I think it's actually one of the movies... I don't know if you could quite say it's the most historically accurate movie, but it really tried the hardest, I think, of any movie to pretty much make a good story and stay historically accurate. I'll quickly do a little overview. What's interesting about this movie is with the overview, they told the history of the Alamo, and I'll add a little bit into their things that maybe the movie didn't add in, but I'll give a little bit more a context. Just really quickly, this is yet another Alamo movie. There was the John Wayne version from the 50s, and then there was a made-for-TV movie, which starred Alec Baldwin, of all people, as William Barrett Travis, which he did a really awesome job. I don't think there was any other really big actors in that one, but that was like the standout, that Alec Baldwin did a great job as William Travis. Now, this Alamo, it has the usual all-star cast that one expects from a great historical period piece movie. You have Dennis Quaid as Sam Houston, and Houston has a larger role in this movie than most Alamo movies. Billy Bob Thornton as Davy Crockett, Patrick Wilson as William Travis, and Jason Patrick as Jim Bowie.
The T-1000, Jason Patrick, yes.
Yes. And then Horty Moya as Juan Seguin. And if you don't recognize his name, you'll definitely recognize his face. He's been in a lot of movies in the 90s and the 2000s. And then there's a number of famous actors from Spanish language TV and film, which I thought was a nice touch. This movie had a huge budget, but unfortunately was kind of a box office flop. The purported goal of the filmmakers was to have this movie be as historically accurate as possible. And, you know, it kind of had a tough job of it because it was always under the shadow of the John Wayne version of the Alamo, which is kind of taken over as the canonical story of the Alamo, no matter what the history of the actual events were.
I'm guessing with John Wayne, having not seen that version, is it any better than The Conqueror in terms of historical accuracy?
It's been a long time since I saw it. They do the standard Davy Crockett wearing the coonskin cap, which that was more of a costume than anything, and wearing the like the really traditional like 1950s movies of leather breeches and a leather jacket, which I think that those you know, like in more of like a Native American Indian style that was not contemporary to the 1830s. You know, again, more of the Davy Crockett costume than actual history. But I think that that movie, for everything, stayed somewhat historically accurate. You know, I think they made the Mexican army more as a classic villain and didn't try and give them more of a 3D picture. But we'll get into that definitely with this Alamo.
Yeah, I mean, the Davy Crockett, obviously you're not going to wear your frontier log cabin getup when you're in the middle of an active war zone and you've served as a U.S. senator. But anyway, that movie's probably gone and buried. So let's go to, you know, better, greener pastures with this one. So, yeah, what's a, I know you have a lot of historical context, but I think it's good to make sense of what this movie gets right and wrong. So what's the background of the Alamo, despite it additionally not having a basement?
Now, as I was saying, the movie actually discusses a good chunk of this setup on the road to the Alamo. Now, starting in the late 1600s, we're going way back, the Spanish began to seriously explore and colonize Texas, and they used their standard method of building a system of missions and presidios, mostly along the major rivers like the San Antonio River. The missions were religious and economic and cultural centers, and friars, mostly Dominicans and Franciscans, would set up a church, farming, school facilities, all in an enclosed area in these missions. And the local Native Americans were encouraged to move into the missions, and they had some incentive to do so. Things were getting pretty rough in Texas. A more warlike Native American groups, they were moving in from the north, and they had horses that were, and horse movement really wrecked through these settled Native Americans, more settled, who didn't have horse technology yet. And there were some different things going on climactically that were making more of Texas plains, as opposed to, you know, a lot of like the bigger trees were dying off. Now, so the local Native Americans, they needed food, they needed shelter, they needed protection from these other groups. And really, in order to go into these missions, the Native Americans had to adopt Christianity, learn Spanish, and then physically live inside of these missions and learn to farm using Spanish methods and basically drop their old culture and language and all that stuff. So a lot of the Native Americans obviously didn't dig that as much. But in this story, that's a different issue. Now, like I said, the missions provided some level of protection from raids and limited attacks, but they were not defensive structures by any stretch of the imagination. They were meant to hold out long enough to get support from the local presidio, and presidios were defensive structures or fortresses with troops and military logistics, and that's where the governors would live, and that's where the civil secular government would be. Thus, Spanish San Antonio, modern day San Antonio, had several missions in close proximity, and then a presidio. The Alamo was one of these missions, and it was located in pretty much modern-day downtown San Antonio, and it was just outside of the actual town of San Antonio, which was a little south of there. And then the governor's palace in Presidio was about a mile or so west of the Alamo. And over the years, the Alamo was used in different capacities, including housing soldiers and cannons, and then it became somewhat of a fort. But keep in mind, it was never designed to be a fort, and that's the situation of probably the most important character of this movie and the whole story of the Alamo, which is the Alamo itself. Now, fast forwarding to the 1800s, Mexico became independent from Spain on September 16th of 1810. And just a little side note, Cinco de Mayo, which I always thought was Mexican Independence Day.
Very common mistake in the United States, yes.
Yeah, that marks a completely different historical event. Much later in history, about a 30 years after this, but completely independent. But anyways, the Constitution of Mexico of 1810 gave Mexico a really weak central government, and the various states of Mexico had a great deal of autonomy. And a place like the Mexican state of Tejas, what they call Texas, was in practice almost a completely independent country from Mexico City.
Yeah, and at this time period, in terms of economic development, I don't know if Mexico is comparable or even richer than the United States, but it had definitely been settled and colonized and established much longer, 1 to 2 centuries longer of serious active colonization with city building. So some of the colonial style cities that still exist in Mexico, like Merida or others, I think date back to the 16th century or so. So there's it'd be interesting. I don't know when America would pass Mexico in terms of economic development. That'd probably be well into the 19th century when industrialization moves on full force and the economy switches from agrarian, a more like Russian style of doing cash crops and other things, to industrialization. But I could see the draw to Mexico at that time.
And the militarily, Mexico was much more developed than the United States military at that time. So I would say for sure, economically, militarily, and definitely even in government structure. I mean, Mexico had structures of government that, like you said, went back 200 plus years into the even longer than that, and cultural institutions. But that during this 18-teens through 1820s and then into the 1830s, many Americans started to move into the really sparsely settled area of Texas. I think in the 1830s, there was only about 30,000 people living in Texas at that time, which made it by far the smallest state of Mexico. Most of the immigrants came from the southeastern part of the United States. And you look at some of the famous early Anglo-Texans called Texians, where they were from. Stephen Austin and Sam Houston were from Virginia. Davy Crockett was from Tennessee. Jim Bowie was from Kentucky. William Travis and his cousin James Bonham, they are from South Carolina, you know, all in the east, southeastern section of the United States, which also happened to be the area where slavery was an important institution. And most of these Anglo-Texians, they weren't just coming from economic reasons, which they brought their slaves. And just as a side note, which would become very important, Mexico had already banned and abolished slavery by this point. So that was a little bit of a sticking point right off the bat, basically. But a lot of these Anglo-Texans, they were also fleeing to evade criminal prosecutions, debt, civil injunctions, really like terrible family matters. Like these weren't high-end people moving to set up stable economies and social structures. Most of the people who were going to Texas were fleeing, running from something.
That's a proud tradition of many of the people who originally immigrated to the United States from Europe were coming for similar reasons. So you know what? We're just paying it forward.
Yeah. Yeah. And the main agent for the Mexican government to recruit Anglo immigrants to come to Texas was a man named Stephen Austin. And he had authority from Mexico City to bring 300 families to settle. But once these families started settling, and they started to settle legally, others came illegally to settle in this the wide open spaces. I mean, you know, you're just talking, there wasn't a very clearly defined border between Mexico and the United States, so it was just easy for people to come and go through the porous border.
Yeah, that's a fact not lost on, I think, many history teachers. I like to point that out. And I've heard that in my own college experience of illegal immigration to Mexico from the United States. Very low-hanging fruit to pick, which, to this movie's credit, it doesn't pick it as ferociously as a lesser movie would have, but we can get to that later.
Yeah. Now all these immigrants, they brought their slaves, and which I said, it, like I was saying, was abolished by the Mexican federal government. And this is where we see some major players come in. The federal Mexican government, which was solidifying power under General Antonio López de Santa Anna, and the Texians, we'll call them Texans, and that was broken into two groups, the Anglos called the Texians and the Mexicans called Tejanos. The Texians and the Tejanos, they both had reasons to dislike the central government, and that's really what kickstarted the Texas Revolution. I think that's something, too, that most other tellings of the Alamo, we'll get into like historicity and all that stuff, but it was a movement of both Tejanos and Texians who wanted independence from the central Mexican government.
Yeah, interesting hybrid culture there. So different reasons to distrust the central authority and the weak hold that the central government has on it up into the north, perhaps them hoping it would be a buffer state due to it being hot and arid and sparsely populated, like the...
Yeah.
I don't know, the way the Roman Empire had the Sahara, thinking that this can ward off any attacks from the south and we can have our African coastal cities. Sorry, Mexico, not to be. It's contiguous land area, so that's not going to work.
Yeah. Now, this leads us to the road to the Alamo. The Texan army had some initial successes because the Mexican army did not have a lot of troops or supplies or anything they really needed in Texas at that time. The Texans took some key towns, including San Antonio. Now, this was during the dead of winter, and they didn't expect the Mexican army to be able to respond until spring. You know, a lot of this happened in late fall, early winter, and they thought that they had a good 5-6 months before, you know, the Mexican army could really get rolling. But Santa Anna, who was known as the Napoleon of the West, he didn't stand around for a second. He was convinced that the professional Mexican army would just steamroll over the ragtag bunch of backwoodsmen of the Texan army. The Mexican army had to march all the way from central Mexico to Texas through some pretty rough terrain. It's a lot of desert throughout there. There's mountains, there's plateaus, rough country, basically all the way from Mexico City to Texas. And the logistics of moving a really large army through northern Mexico, they were not prepared for in the least bit. And that really hurt the army. And although the winter in Texas, you know, you may not compare it to maybe, say, Russia or upstate New York, or I think even where you live, you get some pretty rough winters, don't you?
It's happened. This last winter was pretty rough. So we get our 6 to 8 to 12 inches of snow occasionally.
Yeah, you wouldn't think of that in Texas, but the winter of 1836 was pretty severe by Texas standards, and it set record colds and snowfall, even pretty far deep into northern Mexico. Santa Anna, he had a no mercy policy because the Texans were rebels and he was going to treat them as rebels. So when the army took a fort or met any resistance, they were not taking prisoners. And that leads us to the Battle of the Alamo.
Right. And then with their supply line stretched so thin, it'd be very hard to accommodate prisoners or do anything with them. So it's sort of a pragmatism, but then also sending a very clear message to any other would-be rebels or any of the would-be Americans trying to settle illegally there, since they don't have strong fortifications to defend it. So,
yeah.
All right. So let's get to the movie itself and see how closely it hews to the overview that you just gave.
So there's a lot of setup there, but I think it's important to understand where things stood right before the battle. And the movie develops a lot of what I said in that conflict in the plot, but not entirely. Like, they didn't get into the mission system and all that. But they got into the biographies of a lot of people, like William Travis. For example, he was the commander of the regular Texas Army soldiers at the Alamo. And he was a prince, real prince. He abandoned his family in South Carolina and just heaped all left all of his debts with his wife, which I don't believe he ever saw her again after he had left. He did have some connections with his son, Jim Bowie. He had a checkered background, and he bopped all around the southeastern U.S. getting into fights and conflicts with his gigantic Bowie knife,
yep,
which is named after him. And I think he had been stabbed several times. He still had bullets lodged in his body. And I think he was leaving some sort of like debt situation. And Bowie was the commander of the volunteer contingent at the Alamo. David Crockett, he was a U.S. congressman who ran into some political troubles in Washington. I think it went back to he had a fallout with Andrew Jackson, I believe. And there was all sorts of stuff that had been going on in the 1830s within the Democratic Party. But his district back in Tennessee voted him out of office. And even at this point, Crockett was way more legend than man. And he had a famous line, "You can all go to hell and I shall go to Texas." And he told that all around the parties in Washington. And they showed some part of his scene with Billy Bob Thornton. I think that was the star of the movie. He did it such a great job as Crockett, as somebody who is a cynical politician, but also knew he was a legend. You know, he was a hybrid of politician and backwoodsman. He was all of those things at one time. And I think Billy Bob Thornton just did a great job folding that all together.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Yeah, good guy to play a skinny, wiry, really crazy guy. He nailed it. And with Davy Crockett's personality, there's, I don't know, maybe a little bit of a Teddy Roosevelt. Maybe not quite the polish of Teddy. The knowing representation of himself as a backwoodsman to really try to sell the frontier spirit that he has. He was an actual frontiersman, but he was also doing marketing, sort of like when Benjamin Franklin was an ambassador in France and would wear a coonskin cap, even though he had never lived in a cabin and probably never slept in one his entire life. Crockett had more claim to that, but like Franklin, also a bit of a showman.
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways, Davy Crockett was everything that Teddy Roosevelt wanted to be, but we could lose a lot of listeners if we bash Teddy Roosevelt too much.
Yeah, I mean, he did some, he was rough, don't get me wrong, but he liked to play cowboy in some senses, and he actually did up in Montana for a few years, North Dakota.
Yeah. Now, this divided command structure between regulars led by Travis and the volunteers led by Bowie, you know, you've got two really big personalities, and then you think the regulars, you have the regulars who think they're better than the volunteers, and the volunteers who think they're better than the regulars. I mean, they were ready to fight each other before they were going to fight the Mexicans. And, you know, Travis thought that he should be in overall command because he was the leader of the regulars. And Bowie, on the other hand, was extremely popular and was seen to be the better fighter. Some also thought that Crockett should take command, and he kind of demurred away from all of that. But the practical matter was solved when Bowie, he became very sick shortly into the siege. And the siege took just about a week. And for all the heroics, the battle only lasted a few hours. The Alamo just wasn't made to be a defensive structure, and the defenders really didn't have the time or the resources to truly set it up to defend itself against the cannons and the siege equipment that the Mexicans had, the Mexican army had. Now, William Travis, he was killed very early in the action, and eventually the Mexicans took the entire fort. Only a handful of defenders survived, and you know, they basically, when the Mexican Federals went into the, when they finally did break through the walls, they just killed everyone on the spot. Somewhere about six defenders survived, and this movie included Davy Crockett amongst that small number of survivors. First-hand accounts show that Crockett died in the fighting, but there's also a controversy since the day of the March 6th of 1836, whether Crockett died fighting or was executed the next day. There's a really big controversy over that. But one way or the other, Crockett did die, and over 200 of the defenders died or were executed at the Alamo.
Yeah, I wonder what historians do with sources. I would assume that any accounts that we have would come from the Mexican side, since they survived and the Americans did not. Or if there are other sources that we do have, since nobody would have left it there and were faced with a, what's that situation? It was about 2,000 years ago in Israel when they were fighting against the Romans and there was a mass suicide.
Oh, Masada?
Yeah, that's right. So it would be the Roman. So I don't know one way or another, and I would assume the Mexican accounts are what we have, but perhaps I could be wrong.
There's also, they touched on this in the movie, the Mexican army, they were not to kill African-American slaves. They were to be taken and then freed. And Jim Bowie's slave, I don't know if he escaped or if he was caught in the Alamo and then he was brought to Santa Ana. And I believe he was one of the ones who was at when they were executing. And I want to say that he said that he didn't see Crockett there.
Okay. That's good.
But I could be that one. I'm just shooting from the hip here. And I'm not sure. He was one of the witnesses. There was a couple of, I think one of the people who wrote shortly afterwards, the general consensus is that Crockett died in the fort. The movie actually went with the theory that he died outside of the fort the next day.
Okay, so they're at least hitching their cart to a horse that is, you know, part of one camp of respectable opinion. And the other thing, too, about one of Jim Bowie's slaves, I would imagine that the Mexican army had a policy and would want slaves to get word of, join us and you will be emancipated. I don't know if they did that or not, but that is a time-honored strategy that's used by the Union. I made it known to any slaves in the Confederacy. It's used in the Revolutionary War, where the British make it known to slaves that if you get behind our lines and fight for us, you will be emancipated. So it's a way to try to sap the manpower and maybe stir up a revolt to weaken your enemy forces. So, yep, Mexico is prosecuting a pretty smart war here.
Yeah, they're treating them like rebels. And you know what? Well, we'll see in a few minutes whether that strategy completely worked or not. Now, the defenders of the Alamo, they were really never supposed to defend the Alamo the way they did. They did tie up Santa Anna's forces for some amount of time, but not really for very long. And a lot of people died in the meanwhile. Later in March, Santa Anna fought it out in another town, a little village about 100 miles south and east of the Alamo called Goliad. And another group of Texans tried to fight toe-to-toe with the Mexican army, and that didn't work out well at all either. The Texans were soundly defeated at Goliad, and again, no mercy was granted to the Texan commanders or soldiers. Santa Anna ordered approximately 430 captured soldiers to be summarily executed as rebels, just like the Alamo defenders. And it's probably worth saying that a lot of the Mexican commanders did not want to do this. They were really against this policy, and they thought it was against the rules of war and were not happy to do Santa Anna's biddings on that issue. In the meanwhile, Sam Houston was given command of the Texan army, and they were able to organize and get somewhat of their stuff together, so to speak. Houston always wanted to use hit-and-run strategy against the Mexican armies, and then to just keep drawing them in to lead them to a place where he knew he could have the upper hand, because he knew they could never go toe-to-toe fighting the Mexican Federals using the Mexicans' battle strategy. It was just never going to work. But that hit and run and running basically strategy was not super popular with many Texans, because they wanted instant revenge for all their family and friends and neighbors who had been massacred, not only at the Alamo, but also at Goliad. But Houston was able to hold out, and Houston was able to lead Santa Anna along a series of several small battles, which was called the Runaway Scrape. And finally, Houston found the right ground at a place called San Jacinto, where the Texas Army just hit the Mexicans hard when they were resting in their camp. And I believe the Mexicans had set their camp up on the side of the opposite side, or the side of the river where the Texas Army was. So they didn't have the river for defense. The river was actually at their back. And the Texas Army just ripped through their camp. And there was also Tejanos that were a part of that battle as well, which Sam Houston initially didn't want the Tejanos to fight with them, because he was afraid that the Texians might turn on them. And they had done something. I believe they put a card in their hats that distinguished them from the Mexican Federals. And they portrayed that in the movie, which I thought was a nice touch. The Battle of San Jacinto only lasted 20 minutes, and the entire Mexican army was destroyed, and many of their top commanders, including Santa Anna, were captured. There were definitely acts of no mercy from the Texans, but Sam Houston wanted Santa Anna alive, and he wanted to show that he was the bigger man and that the Texans were, you know, more honorable than the Mexicans. So even despite that the Texans wanted to kill Santa Anna on the spot, Houston refused, and he was able to get Santa Anna to grant Texas independence from Mexico on very favorable terms right on the spot. And that's, in a nutshell, the entire movie.
All right. Yeah. Very good wrap up. And there you are. Texas for a while remains an independent nation. I believe in Great Britain, there was actually a consulate of the Republic of Texas, which has been turned into a restaurant that you can go there today.
Oh, that's cool.
So whatever the name of the restaurant is, has something to do with the consulate of the Republic of Texas. There were Texas diplomats. They're probably planning to set up different embassies and across Europe. But then it becomes a state, and the rest is history. I didn't get a chance to look this up. There's the common fact I've heard that the Texas flag is the only flag that's legally allowed to fly equal to the American flag due to a term of Texas joining the Union. I've heard somewhere that that's made up. It's custom to place a state flag before the national flag, but there's nothing preventing a state flag being flown at the same height. It might be custom and nothing legal. So that's my little bit of Texas historical trivia.
Yeah, there's a lot of things like that, that Texas can secede at any time, yeah, or that it can split into four states. A whole bunch of things like that that are questionable.
Six Flags Park, named that because there were six sovereign flags that flew over Texas in its history. Spain, France, Mexico, Texas, the Confederacy, and the United States. There you are.
Yeah, that's a cool little fact, too.
So, what do you think, Sia? I guess there's a lot of liked about this movie, so what were some of your favorite things?
I loved that the characters were really well played. They had a really good cast. I thought that, you know, you can't get enough Jason Patrick. Patrick Wilson's pretty good. Billy Bob Thornton as Davy Crockett's one of the best of all times, and one of Thornton's best roles, I think. It was a beautiful movie. It was shot somewhere in Texas. You can see they did put a lot of money into the movie. The sets are really good. The clothes are really good. I think the clothes were pretty period, and I think they spent a lot of time on making the clothing as period as possible. And they did a really good job of showing the Mexican side as well. They showed Santa Anna as kind of buffoonish, kind of clownish, which he kind of was. I mean, that's part of he was a bigger than life character, and they'd maybe play that up a little bit, but he was a complicated guy.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack, and I think from something I read is part of the reason there was a lot of money in the set design is that Ron Howard was originally set by the studio to direct the movie. For whatever reason, he backed out. But with a bigger name director, you could probably also get full-fledged A-listers. So this is set in the early 2000s-ish. Whoever would have been big there, Brad Pitt, Russell Crowe, whoever, some marquee star to be there. You don't quite have that with this movie. So with less money having to be paid out to an A-lister, then you can spend more on the actual film production and the set design and costumes and other stuff.
Yeah, I think they said that Russell Crowe was going to be Sam Houston, and I think Dennis Quaid played a much better Sam Houston than Russell Crowe would have.
Yeah, which, I thought Master and Commander, that would have been another film possibility for the series, which Russell Crowe was in. That's neither here nor there. But
yeah, he's done his fair amount of historical pieces. Oh, yeah, and Dennis Quaid is from Texas. He's from Houston. So I think it'd be pretty a lot of the actors actually were Texans. Billy Bob Thornton is, I think he's from either Texas or he might be from Arkansas. But there were some other Texan actors in there as well.
Nice. Any other high points you think for this film?
I think that those are the big ones that I really liked. Is that it was overall probably about as accurate as you can get in a major motion picture, and that the battle scenes were accurate and it was fun to watch. I think they balanced those two things out is well as any movie, really.
Yeah, and something I like too is that it captures the epicness of the event and why we remember it, but it also doesn't make it out to be something that it wasn't, and this archetypal moment where the characters are practically looking into the future and speaking of the significance of this moment and making significance when it didn't exist. And what I mean by that is, from what I've read of the John Wayne movie, you mentioned that it had created perceptions of the Alamo that have stayed in the American conscious. And one point is that the characters seem to, they purposely decide to stay and not try to sneak out of the Alamo or go over a wall one night with the idea that they can slow down the Mexican army and give Sam Houston enough time for total victory. You mentioned earlier that Goliad probably had much more to do with that than the Alamo, since the Alamo simply wasn't that much more. It wasn't a major fortification. There weren't that many people there. Incredible symbolic value, but in terms of overall military strategic value, much smaller. And so the John Wayne movie doesn't get that. I think this one captures the, not that it was meaningless, but I think the soldiers were, they were more just trapped in. It's not like they had a courageous symbolic, you know, decision to stand and fight. So that's something there that I think it would be easy to kind of gloss over and miss on. But
it's been a long time since I saw the John Wayne version, but he did one of his I do remember his classic looking out into the horizon and giving the prophetic speech, you know, the classic John Wayne. We saw it in The Conqueror. He did it in the Green Beret.
He's like speaking with destiny itself as he's talking.
Yeah. I mean, he's John Wayne, and they did not do any of that in this movie.
Right. So what would you say to make it better?
I think to make it better, now the Alamo, that's obviously the money. That's what everybody remembers. But I think if there was a way that the Goliad massacre could get fit in there, I think that's really important. The battle cry at San Jacinto was not just remember the Alamo. It was remember the Alamo, remember Goliad. Goliad was huge. And I think that that's really... if they could have maybe, I mean, now you're talking about getting back into miniseries country. I think I would like to see a little bit more about the Mexican side, especially how they got themselves mobilized to do a really incredible march through the entirety of Mexico to get to Texas. That would have been really interesting. And just a little bit more about Goliad.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Grand Canyon University's RN to BSN online degree program makes earning your bachelor's in nursing possible. Balance online coursework with local in-person clinicals to position yourself for potential leadership opportunities in the time you have from wherever you are, leaving room for what matters. Achieve your goals with your personalized plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.
Yeah, I think I really don't have that many arguments because, for example, the movie does do a pretty good job of showing the Mexican side. So Juan Seguin, the main Tejano ally, he works with them to fight the dictator. And one thing in the movie is that Santa Anna, it somehow makes a point that he kills prisoners because he fears that Mexico's independence could be taken away if their grandchildren are ruled by Americans. That seems more like him making a prophetic statement where he's somehow speaking to future tensions between Mexico and the United States. But his actions were more just his policy of maybe a scorched earth. I guess you could call it a Sherman's March to the Sea thinking. Or Curtis LeMay, the general who architected the firebombing of Tokyo, that let us do harsh now so that we can save lives in the future, which is one philosophy of how to conduct warfare. But it wasn't for any sort of let's do this now for the future of Mexican-American relations. That's a small quibble, because really, a lesser director and a lesser screenwriter would have just stuffed this to the gills with contemporary commentary on, I don't know, the immigration debate, because like we said, there's that low hanging fruit of Americans coming illegally into Mexico. And that's why I hate Kingdom of Heaven so much, because when I was writing up a description of that for our series, I wrote, Legolas the elf travels to the Middle East to create universal harmony between Muslims and Christians. And like, he might as well like wear a shirt that says tolerance or coexist for how anachronistic he is, because there's a great story to be told of the Crusades. And I like, it's religious violence is terrible, but
it makes a good story.
Yeah. I mean, there's something to be gained by understanding why people in the past did things, even if you don't agree with it, so you can be transported to another world. But a lazy writer is, I'm going to make a commentary on the Iraq War, the 2005. Well, why not just make an Iraq War movie and then do it that way? And this, the Alamo, a lesser director, could have made a direct allegory for U.S.-Mexico relations and the immigration debate, but it didn't do that. So there you go.
Yeah, and I think that it was a good period piece that stuck to the history. And I would just highly suggest people go watch it. It's available on all the streaming services, et cetera. I think sometimes it's even available on Netflix for free. So I would definitely go watch it.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, Steve, anything else on the Alamo?
No, I think we're good. I think I made the case that it's a movie that people should go and watch, and I think they're going to love it.
Absolutely. All right, in the next episode, we're going to talk about another movie that was loved, specifically by me. We're going to look at the 2014 schlock masterpiece, Dracula Untold. All right, well, that wraps up our exploration of the past for this episode. As always, I want to thank the Knowlton's Rangers, especially our spy masters, Todd Warren, Jake Harrington, Beverly Ingle, Bill Ivey, Joyce Norman, Tyler from Colorado, Josh Reddick, Baron Fraser, Chris from Maine, Carl from Norway, Moondoggy from Ohio, Rick Knowlton, Vic and Irene, Mike from New York, Michelle, and Marlene. I'll explain what that is in a second. If you like the show and want to help it grow, there are four easy ways for you to do it. One, like and subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice. This helps spread the word about the show. Two, join our Facebook group. Here we can keep the discussion going about new episodes, and you can talk about what you like and didn't like. And you can find this group if you just search for History Unplugged on Facebook. Three, we have an online store with t-shirts, phone covers, and other accessories featuring awesomely bad history puns that were crowdsourced by you, the audience. And you can find that if you go to teepublic.com and look for History Unplugged, or you just go to historyonthenet.com and look for our store there. Four, and this is really the best way to dive deep with History Unplugged, and that's to become one of the Knowlton's Rangers. If you know your American history, you know the Knowlton's Rangers were an elite spy and reconnaissance group in the American Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program of History Unplugged. You can join at three levels. If you join at the level of Scout, you can hear all the episodes of History Unplugged completely ad-free and get early access to new episodes, at least a week early. If you join at the Intelligence Officer level, you get special bonus episodes, like a 10-part series on the World War II hero Audie Murphy, a multi-part series called Ottoman Lives about different people in the Ottoman Empire, and a series called Rendezvous with Death that looks at biographical profiles of Americans who went to fight in World War I before America entered the war. The last level is Spymaster, where you get all that stuff, but you also get three hardcover history books, Forging a President, How the Wild West Created Teddy Roosevelt, Race to the Top of the World, Richard Byrd and the First Flight to the North Pole, and The Last Fighter Pilot, the true story of the final combat mission of World War II. Another bonus is, you can choose a history topic for me to focus on for an entire episode that can go up to an hour, and I'll answer whatever question you have for me, and you get a shout-out at the end of each episode. If you want to learn how to become a member of the Knowlton's Rangers, go to patreon.com/unplugged. That's patreon.com/unplugged. All right, well, that is all for my spiel. Thanks for listening to the History Unplugged podcast, from ancient Greece to the Cold War and everything else in between. See you next time. This episode is brought to you by Calitrin. Text the word unplugged to 30605, and I'll send you a link to a wonderful product that can help you finally succeed in shedding that extra weight. I took Calitrin for several weeks last year, and I felt great in several ways. I felt stronger, my workouts felt easier, I slept better, I was noticeably trimmer, there was no downside. Text the word unplugged to 30605 right now to see this week's special offer on Calitrin. Calitrin contains collagen, the most abundant protein naturally occurring in the human body, which decreases as we age. Taking Calitrin promotes better sleep, more energy, less joint pain, and best of all, weight loss. Calitrin has an 86% success rate with their 90-day supply, and this week, take advantage of my special offer. Buy the 90-day supply and get an extra month free, plus free shipping. Ordering is easy. Just text the word unplugged to 30605, and I'll send you a link to the special offer. Again, text unplugged to 30605.
They were some of the most powerful men who've ever lived. They waged war, forged peace, and altered the fates of billions of people. And yet, they were just as human, just as flawed as you and me. They were the presidents of the United States, and they are the subjects of the history podcast, This American President. In each episode of This American President, we explore how flawed men have managed this awesome responsibility. To listen now, go to ParthenonPodcast.com or search This American President on your favorite podcast platform.